It doesn't matter who we are, change happens.
I flatlined.
Sometimes it's forced on us.
You know there's more than one baby here.
Sometimes we choose it.
There's a time where you just need to jump.
But when it happens, it changes everything.
I just stopped the drugs on the Sunday.
So how do we respond to it? Join me, Ruda Landman, to explore that in our podcast, When Change Happens. Listen at changepodcasts.co.za.
He can hear them talking outside as he rummages through the drawers. He pockets everything of value and then gives the signal. There will be no witnesses. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht and you're listening to episode 169, The Serial Crimes of Sean Oosthuizen. And it's that time again when I highlight the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And this Monday, the 18th of November, sees the return of Killer Cases, with Season 3 showing exclusively on CBS Justice. All the emotion and suspense of America's most chilling murder trials are captured in this immersive true crime roller coaster, as each episode walks viewers through the investigation and then right into the courtroom, capturing every twist of unfolding legal drama. Watch a standalone episode Monday to Friday at 9:20 a.m., 1:45 p.m. and 8 p.m. from the 18th of November to the 3rd of December on DSTV Channel 170. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Abigail Ings, Azepele, Lucy Pritchard, Daniel Wyoming, Emmy Corbis, and Cindy Yallop for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Today's case is a perfect illustration of how the term serial murderer does not always present the way we expect it to in actual crimes. It's also a terrible example of how, very often, criminals will purposefully target some of the most vulnerable in society because they know they're easier targets. My resources for today's episode include several media articles and court documents. So, let's get into episode 169, The Serial Crimes of Sean Oosthuizen.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
There's not a lot of information available about the main offender in today's case. Sean Oosthuizen was born in 1980. By the time he was 19, he'd fathered his first child, whose life he would be in and out of. He had already started to fall foul of the law, and over the years he would be in and out of prison 7 times for theft and robbery before he moved on to committing the series of crimes I'm discussing in today's episode. When Sean was not in prison, he worked as a mechanic, mostly informally, and performed repairs on people's vehicles privately to earn money. In 2013, Sean was released from prison for his most recent stint and would eventually move to Munsieville outside Krugersdorp. The area was first developed in 1905 to house miners and quickly developed as a township and also an informal settlement over the years. Perhaps the most famous resident by birth of Munsieville is the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu. It's likely that Sean's move to Munsieville was part of a 2014 shift that happened, which significantly changed the demographics of the area. At that time, a large group of mainly white, Afrikaans-speaking residents of Krugersdorp were living in a caravan park called Coronation. The group had been living on the land for many years when the owners took steps to have them removed, as they wished to renovate the very decrepit facilities at Coronation. After much disagreements, the group eventually moved to a portion of land at Munsieville, which they called Pango Camp. The informal settlement area was actually quite widely reported on, even in the international media, because it was one of the first times that people were seeing large groups of white people living alongside people of colour in a township. Now, you would have heard me mention before that the vast majority of South African townships were formed under the apartheid government as a way to implement the Group Areas Act, which was a tool used by that government to further racial segregation geographically. Most of these areas are not given the same level of resources and attention by municipalities as built-up suburban areas are, and there are often large groups of very economically vulnerable people living there. The coverage of the Pango camp was, in my mind, a rather bizarre but also telling exposition of the remnants of apartheid legacies still very present and relevant in a society that was simultaneously moving forward while still hinged to the past. The Pango camp group became widely known, and many of the individuals living there used this coverage to drive donations to the residents. And what does this have to do with Sean Oosthuizen and today's case, you may ask? Well, I mention all of this because Sean was living in Munsieville and seeing all of this play out. And when donation drives were created online, and especially on social media, it seems that Sean, both on his own and soon with cohorts, would utilize the offers of donation of physical goods to further his own agendas. Shortly after moving to Munsieville, Sean Oosthuizen became involved in a relationship, and the woman he was with fell pregnant and gave birth to his child. He would later say that he had supported the child financially when he could, but the mother of the child was also unemployed, so she had predominantly relied on government grants to get by. Also, after moving to Munsieville, Sean began spending more time with Johnny DePloy. DePloy was 12 years younger than Sean, and I will say that in one article, Sean is actually referred to as Johnny's uncle. I cannot say for sure whether this is an actual blood relation uncle or just a word that was used to describe the older man being in an elder-like position where Johnny was concerned. It's not impossible that he is his blood uncle if Sean's siblings were a bit older than him. I became an aunt for the first time when I was 10 years old, so Sean being an uncle at 12 is entirely possible. Either way, the two men began to spend quite a lot of time together. Johnny DePloy had fathered a child when he was 16 years old, and would later tell a judge that he did not financially contribute to that child's upbringing at all. He did not have the extensive criminal record that Oosthuizen had, and by the time he was eventually arrested for the crimes in this series, he didn't actually have a single offence to his name. Of course, that doesn't mean he hadn't committed any crimes, it just means he'd never been caught. After he moved to Munseyville, he started working with Sean, fixing cars. But it would later become clear that he was working with him in other ways too. There is a third individual involved in this series of crimes, but we don't at this point have solid proof about which crimes she was or was not involved in, and because she hasn't yet spent any considerable amount of time in court, there also isn't a lot of information about her in the public domain. The woman's name is Morena Forster. She went by Mandy, and she would later get married and changed her surname from Forster to Ma'am. Morena did have a criminal history. In fact, there was a warrant of arrest out for her for a theft case at one point. She had four previous convictions. One was for the assault of a police officer, and the outstanding warrant for the arrest was for the theft of a cell phone at an old age home in Bela Bela, Limpopo. She too lived in Munseyville and became friendly with Oosthuizen and DePloy. Now I will say up front, before I begin speaking about the crimes and the victims, that we don't know for sure that this group used the donations to Pango Camp as a way to rob, and yes, eventually kill their victims, but it was mentioned by these individuals as a way to excuse their presence on properties in question. On the other end of this, as we discuss the various cases, you'll see that there definitely seems to be an element of chance-taking, and Oosthuizen was once convicted of a robbery with a similar victim and modus operandi profile, where the victim was not murdered. So it's very possible that Oosthuizen collecting donations for Pango Camp had been the start of him realizing that this was a demographic, a victim he could easily target. And after that, he didn't necessarily need the donation excuse to strike. He just figured out how he could get in. You'll come to understand when I talk about the arrests and prosecutions of Oosthuizen's crimes that he was not charged and convicted in the chronological order of when these crimes occurred, because police didn't know about all of them at the same time. But I'm going to talk about them in chronological order, so that you can see the pattern of behaviour and how Oosthuizen got away with so much, and possibly even more than we'll ever know. 93-year-old Emma Horson lived in a retirement home in Sunnyside. Her apartment was on the 8th floor of the building. On the 5th of December 2015, Emma had not been seen for 2 days, and employees in the complex, unable to reach her by phone, entered her apartment. They found Emma in a cupboard in the home. Her hands had been tied behind her back, and a piece of material had been placed into her mouth, with another piece of material tied across her face to hold the gag in place. Emma had unbelievably survived in the cupboard for 2 days after having been attacked and robbed in her home. She was alive when she was discovered, but barely clinging to life. And sadly, she passed away a week later in hospital. The individual who had attacked Emma had stolen jewellery worth about 50,000 rand from her home. I only found one mention of this murder in the media from the time when it happened. It was about 5 or 6 lines in an online article. And it would become clear that after Emma's death, the investigation into her murder stalled, and nothing more came to light to help identify her killer. It would be almost another 5 years before there was any more movement on this case, but police could have no idea that a modus operandi was established here. An elderly female victim living in a retirement village type setup, an unknown individual gains access to her home, not by force, but seemingly by being let in. The victim is restrained by binding and a gag is placed in the mouth, with another piece of material used to tie the gag in place. There is no mention of Emma being strangled, but certainly in later cases this would be added to the crimes. As with many serial offender cases, gaps in crimes are suspicious to me. And in this series, it looks as though the next crime occurs in 2018. Now, Emma Horsens' murder is also around the same time that Sean Oosthuizen seems to have become a dad for the second time. So it's possible that he was distracted and focusing on the relationship that child was born from. Either way, the next time this series seems to restart is on the 24th of June, 2018. 86-year-old Engela van Wyk was a well-loved resident of the Rus Abiki retirement village in Springs. She was always the one residents called on for advice and a friendly chat over a cup of coffee. Engela was very close with her daughter Alna, and they visited together almost every day. The older woman was very committed to her family and loved watching her 5 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren grow and flourish in their lives. Engela was a brilliant knitter, and she loved knitting booties and other items for her new great-grandchildren. In June 2018, she was working on 2 knitting projects for 2 new great-grandchildren who were due to be born later in the year. The beanies and booties would eventually be completed by family members and handed down to the newborn children by others, because Engela would not be there to do it herself. On the 24th of June, other residents of Rus Abiki said there were 2 men in the complex who'd been knocking on doors asking to use the toilet or for a glass of water. Engela van Wyk must have let them into her home when others didn't answer, because later that day, she would be found bound and gagged with a piece of material wrapped around her head, deceased, on the floor of her bedroom. The rag that had been shoved into Engela's mouth had blocked her airways, and she'd suffocated to death. Her home had been ransacked, with small, easily portable items being stolen, such as cash and a cell phone and jewellery. It was clear that the individuals who had killed Engela had not wanted to create suspicion by walking out with large items like a television. Engela's daughter received the news of her murder while she was on holiday in KwaZulu-Natal. Devastatingly, she would later reveal that her mother was not even supposed to be home on the day she was killed. Engela had intended to go with her daughter and her family on holiday, but she'd caught a bug a few days before they were meant to leave, and the family decided it would be safer for Engela to stay home and recuperate. Engela's murder horrified local residents, but it was not connected to the prior murder of Emma Horsen just yet. 3 years had passed, and the previous murder had taken place in a completely different jurisdiction. But the killers were now gaining momentum, and the next murder would be far sooner. Just 2 weeks after the murder of Engela van Wyk in Gauteng, two men and a woman arrived at the SAVF Hersakker old age home in Mbombela in the Mpumalanga province. They told the security guard at Hersakker that they were there to collect donations from a Tani Māori, and they were let in. They then went from door to door, but there were many people visiting that day, and they seemed unable to find a resident who was suitable to what they had planned, so they left. Later, they arrived at Macadamia Care Centre, just 2 kilometres away. The security cameras at Macadamia recorded them entering in a vehicle at 12:07 in the afternoon. They parked in a visitor's parking area and began to walk around the complex, knocking on doors, asking to use the bathroom. They would often use the excuse that they were waiting for their grandmother to arrive and needed to use the toilet. 85-year-old Henrietta Pokhita, affectionately called Heta by her friends and family, opened the door for them and let them in. The cameras once again recorded the vehicle leaving the centre with the 3 individuals inside about 30 minutes later. Later that night, one of the neighbours decided to check in on Heta. They knew that she was someone who usually went to bed early, and yet they heard her television on late into the night. After knocking for several minutes with no response, the neighbour became concerned that Heta may have fallen, so the estate manager entered her home to check on her. Just moments later, a panicked call would come in to Mbombela police. Lieutenant Colonel Erhard Stroh was called to the Macadamia Care Centre to attend a scene that he had no idea would change the next few years of his life and career. It would take him to the depths of human depravity and leave him aghast at how his work as a police officer to serve and protect the citizens of South Africa could so easily be scuppered by a judiciary who was not on the same page and seemed to refuse to listen. When Lieutenant Colonel Stroh arrived at Heta Pokhita's home in Macadamia Care Centre, he found the television set still on. There was no forced entry, but the house had been ransacked, and it was clear that a violent robbery had taken place. Heta was found in her bathroom. Her arms and legs were bound, and there was a cloth shoved into her mouth and a piece of material bound around her face. There was also a sanitary towel stuck over her nose, and Heta had clearly been beaten as there was bruising around her face and her nose was bleeding. The pathologist would later determine that Heta had died from suffocation. Her safe was open and 10,000 rand cash as well as a lot of jewellery was missing. As Heta Pokhita's family were receiving the devastating news of her murder, Stroh was hard at work looking for evidence. His first port of call had been the CCTV system at Macadamia Care Centre. There, he identified a vehicle with 3 individuals who had entered at 12:07. He watched as the individuals returned to the vehicle 30 minutes later, and one of the men had a piece of cloth in his hands. Stroh noted the number plate, which was an Mpumalanga plate, and ran it through Natus. It came back as a fake number plate. Although this would not help him to catch his suspects, he and a local community safety organisation would work tirelessly over the next few days to trace the vehicle's movements on the LPR, or license plate recognition cameras, around Mbombela. They managed to ascertain that the vehicle had been at Hersakker Old Age Home just before it had been at Macadamia. And after viewing that facility CCTV, they noticed that the occupants of the vehicle had changed the license plate on the vehicle after exiting there. The original plates were visible on Hersakker's cameras, and it was a GP plate, which, when run through NATIS, was found to be valid and matched the description of the vehicle seen on the footage. Now, I cannot find any information about whether this vehicle was actually registered to any of the three individuals, but I don't think it was. I think the most likely scenario is that it was a vehicle that had been sent in for repairs to a mechanic. A mechanic called Sean Oosthuizen. Oosthuizen had not been back to Munsieville since the day that Hetta Porgieter was murdered, Stroh would discover. And no one knew where he was. Or, at least, they said they didn't. But again, using LPR and putting the alert out to fellow police officers to be on the lookout for the vehicle, Stroh hit pay dirt about a week after Hetta was murdered. The vehicle had been seen at the Lovers Rock Caravan Park in Michaliesburg, and it was still parked there. Stroh moved in. At the caravan park, Stroh and his fellow officers detained Sean Oosthuizen, Johnny Duploy, and Marina Forster. When Stroh identified the three and discovered Oosthuizen's long criminal history, as well as Marina Forster's most recent arrest warrant for a theft from a retirement home, he knew he was onto something. At first, the three insisted they didn't know what he was talking about, but when Stroh revealed that he had them and the vehicle they'd been driving on CCTV, they admitted that they'd been at the Macadamia Center that day, but they claimed they'd been there to collect donations from Hetta Porgieter, who they claimed had sent a Facebook message to someone arranging donations for Pango Camp. They said that when they left the premises, Hetta had been very much alive. The three were charged with the murder of Hetta Porgieter. Marina Forster, though, would be released and charges against her withdrawn. Although they were able to see the figure of a woman on the CCTV, police could not place Marina there, so the charges were withdrawn in the hopes that the ongoing investigation would reveal more evidence. In bail hearings that followed, it was revealed that Stroh had been contacted by other SAPS officers about cases they had in their areas. These included robberies at retirement homes, but also the murders of Engela van Wyk and Emma Horsen. In testimony in court, Stroh indicated to the magistrate that Oosthuizen and Deploy were being investigated for links to other possible crimes. In a short YouTube video I watched, Stroh explains to the magistrate that these links are being investigated. The magistrate then asks if the crimes being investigated are related to the murder of Hetta Porgieter, for which the pair are appearing before him at the time. Stroh says no, but the crimes have the same modus operandi, and he is clearly trying to get across to the magistrates that he believes he has a couple of serial offenders standing in front of him. At the same time, he doesn't want to give away too much information and play his hand too early, which is understandable. But the magistrate does not seem to grasp the importance of the possible serial offender behaviour and seems to push Stroh's statement aside with an attitude that I perceived as, well, if it doesn't pertain to this crime, it's not my problem. A journalist would later report that they had counted six occasions on which Stroh had told the magistrates that it was his opinion as a highly experienced police officer that if he released the three on bail, they would reoffend. Stroh fully believed this, and he had every reason to. But the magistrate did not listen, and instead, on the 3rd of August 2018, he released Oosthuizen and Duploy on bail of 2,000 rand each. 77-year-old Lillis Jane Merry became a great-grandmother for the first time around the time that Oosthuizen and his cohorts were being arrested. Her family said that she was over the moon to be able to watch her great-grandchild grow and was also looking forward to and preparing for the wedding of one of her grandchildren, which was taking place in September. Her loved ones would say that she wasn't terribly well off financially and relied mainly on her family for support. Lillis didn't live in a retirement village. She lived with her son in a flat in Roodepoort. On the 20th of August 2018, her biggest worry had been figuring out what she was going to wear to her grandchild's wedding. Her son had gone to work as usual that day, but he'd returned home to a scene of complete horror. He found his mother dead on her bed. She'd been bound, and a gag had been placed in her mouth, with a piece of material tied around it. Missing from the home was 500 rand, three cell phones, and a small amount of jewellery. Just 2 weeks after Lillis Merry's murder, on the 1st of September 2018, 77-year-old Barbara Fenton was visited by her daughter and granddaughter at the retirement village she lived in Alberton. The women had lunch together that day and snapped photographs of a smiling Barbara. Barbara was dropped off at home just after 4 p.m. Around the same time, Barbara's neighbour received an intercom call from the gate. A man told her that he was looking for Tani Marty and asked if they could be buzzed in. The neighbour thought he might be looking for her, so she did buzz him through. A few minutes later, when no one had arrived at her door, the woman looked outside and saw a vehicle parked outside her neighbour, Barbara's house. She couldn't explain why she'd felt suspicious, but she took a picture of the vehicle. And then, thinking that perhaps the man had actually been looking for Barbara, she went back into her house. Later that evening, Barbara's son-in-law came knocking. He told the woman that he'd come by to drop something off that Barbara had asked for, but she wasn't answering the door or her phone, and he was concerned. He didn't want to barge into the woman's house in case she was in the bath, so he gave the neighbour a spare key he had and asked if she could go inside and check on Barbara. Within a few seconds, the woman hurried back outside, pale as a ghost and in tears. Barbara was found dead on the floor of her home. She was bound, and a gag had been inserted into her mouth with another piece of material wrapped around her head. A pathologist would later confirm that Barbara had also been beaten and strangled. Her hyoid bone was broken, and finger-shaped bruising could be seen around her neck, indicating that she had been manually strangled. A large amount of jewellery was stolen from Barbara's home, as well as her cell phone. Not long after Barbara Fenton's murder, Lieutenant Colonel Stroh received a call. The SAPS in Alberton and Roodepoort believed that the suspect he'd arrested just the month before may be responsible for the murders of Lillis Merry and Barbara Fenton. After a meeting where the evidence on all cases was compared and the modus operandi was found to be so clearly similar, the key elements sealed the deal when Stroh was shown the photograph of the vehicle the neighbour had seen outside Barbara's house. It was the same vehicle that Oosthuizen, De Plooy and Forster had been arrested in, and which had appeared at the scene of Hetta Potgieter's murder. Stroh tracked down Oosthuizen and De Plooy soon after, and the men were rearrested and charged with the murders of Lillis Merry and Barbara Fenton. This time, thankfully, they were not granted bail. Over the next few months, the two were kept in custody as police waited for DNA results to be returned from several specimens found at the scenes. These included DNA found on the gags and bindings used to restrain and suffocate the victims, as well as DNA found on cigarette butts on the scene. It would take a full year for the proceedings to begin in earnest, and on the 5th of November 2019, the trial for the murder of Barbara Fenton began. The states had managed to gather strong enough evidence in this case so that they could get started. And they decided to do so, so that they could ensure Oosthuizen and De Plooy did not slip through their fingers again. Meanwhile, the investigations and forensic testing on the other cases had continued. Both De Plooy and Oosthuizen pleaded not guilty to both the murder and the robbery with aggravating circumstances, but did plead guilty to robbery without aggravating circumstances. Their case was that they'd gone to Barbara's home that day, but their original reason for going there was to collect donations for Pango Camp. De Plooy said that when they'd arrived, he'd asked Barbara if he could charge his cell phone and followed her into her bedroom. Oosthuizen said he'd followed them and noticed that there was jewellery laying around, and it was then, on the spur of the moment, that he decided to rob her. He said he'd grabbed her and covered her mouth with his hand. Then they tied her up, gagged her, and tied the piece of material around her mouth. Amazingly, in their plea statement, both men denied physically harming the deceased, as though manhandling, binding, and gagging an elderly woman is not the exact definition of harming someone. The state turned down the guilty plea on the robbery without aggravating circumstances, and the trial proceeded. Barbara's neighbour, who had let the men into the complex and taken the photograph of their vehicle, Barbara's daughter, and Barbara's son-in-law, who discovered her body, had all testified. The accused's defence was that they'd only robbed Barbara and tied her up, and someone else must have come in after they'd left and strangled her to death. Both Oosthuizen and De Plooy took the stand to offer their versions, and Oosthuizen claimed that he'd left the victim alone with De Plooy for a while as he'd searched the house for valuables, and he didn't know what De Plooy may have done during that time. De Plooy, for his part, denied strangling Barbara. The judge would eventually determine that the accused's version could not be reasonably or possibly true and found both men guilty of Barbara's murder, as well as robbery with aggravating circumstances. They each received a life sentence for the murder and 20 and 25 years respectively for the robbery charge. Due to the nature of the series, many of the trials were ongoing at the same time, and some would be completed earlier than others. Of course, to come, which no one knew, was also a global pandemic that would delay things significantly. But the prosecution and Lieutenant Colonel Stroh were clearly not willing to let any of the crimes go unpunished, and they continued on with each of the trials against the men. In 2020, the trial for the murder of Engela van Wyk was concluded, and De Plooy and Oosthuizen were once again handed down life sentences for the murder and additional years for the robbery. While serving these sentences, it seems that Sean Oosthuizen began to tire of being called back to court time and again, either that or he had a sudden stroke of conscience, and told Stroh that he'd like to confess to the murders of Emma Horsen in 2015 and Lillis Mary. He claimed to have committed these crimes on his own, and as a result, De Plooy was not brought to trial for them. Instead, Oosthuizen was handed down another two life sentences for these murders, bringing his total at the time to four. When the trial for the murder of Hetta Potgieter finally came around, the charges against De Plooy were withdrawn, as the state was not certain they had enough evidence. But Sean Oosthuizen was found guilty of her murder and handed down a fifth life sentence. I must say that I was pleasantly surprised to see the state continue to prosecute Oosthuizen even though he already had so many life sentences. This rarely happens, as it's often not seen as a good use of resources. But I think the victims' families really deserve this. And I have no doubt that Lieutenant Colonel Stroh enjoyed the result too. And with that, we would think that the saga of the retirement home killers was complete. But Stroh was not finished yet. In 2022, after new evidence was discovered in the case of Hetta Potgieter, Johnny Duploy was charged with her murder once again. And this time, he would be found guilty and handed down a third life sentence. And Stroh was still not done. He had never felt quite right about Marina Foster not facing justice, although in the interim she had been found guilty of a theft charge related to a retirement home robbery. So he started going through all of the case information again, often in his own time and after hours. And he realized that there was evidence in the case of Engela van Wyk that had not been processed fully yet. Some wide-awake first responders had collected cigarette butts that were found at the scene. Some of the butts had matched back to Oosthuizen, which had helped to secure his conviction. But it struck Stroh while he was going through some of the old arrest documents that Marina Foster was also a smoker. When she'd been arrested, a pack of cigarettes had been found in her pockets. So, taking a chance, Stroh asked the lab to compare the remaining cigarette butts to Forster's DNA. And it matched. Forster was charged with the murder of Engela van Wyk. I don't see any updates on this trial, so it still seems to be ongoing, but I will try and follow it up and give you updates in the future. If Forster is found guilty, she could be facing a life sentence under common purpose, even if she did not physically touch Engela that day. And perhaps then, Stroh will really be done with the trio. There is another case that I found while researching that never seems to have been positively linked to the group, but does seem oddly similar. On the 3rd of February 2017, Pat Tutta was found murdered in her home in the Mugapong Old Age Home complex in Limpopo. Pat's was found by concerned neighbours about a day after she was killed. Her body was covered with a carpet and a towel, and she'd been suffocated to death. As with all the other scenes, there was no sign of forced entry, indicating that the victim had willingly let the perpetrator or perpetrators into the home, and only small valuables had been stolen. I can only guess that the lack of binding and gagging is perhaps what swayed the prosecution and investigation team from including this case in the series. But you might remember that Marina Foster was found guilty of a theft of a cell phone from a retirement home in Limpopo. There's something deeply disturbing about this case. Despite there not being particularly gruesome violence involved, there's just this coldness about these offenders, especially Oosthuizen, who was clearly the mastermind. That is incredibly chilling. It's very clear that both Oosthuizen and Forster had previously targeted retirement homes and they'd come to see elderly women as the ideal victim. They purposefully targeted individuals who could not fight back, who would be trusting, and who would be willing to help. In addition, Forster's involvement, although she remains to stand trial for murder, but has been proven to have stolen from these types of victims in the past, was, I think, very tactical. It's much easier to get a woman who lives on her own to put her guard down when there's another woman present. And this group seems to have used that to their full advantage when they could. Of course, the most stomach-churning part of this case is the fact that Oosthuizen continued to kill when he was out on bail. Because he clearly just didn't care. And no, he absolutely should never have been out on bail. While magistrates and judges cannot be sued civilly for poor judgments, they absolutely can be disciplined internally. And I certainly hope the magistrate in this case went back and reviewed his own decision to see where he might be able to improve in future. While the loss of any victim at any age is horrifying, there's something particularly terrifying about the predation of individuals who are already likely in the last years of their lives. People who are living day to day, just trying to enjoy life as much as they can after having contributed to society and raised families. Victims who, by virtue of their age, are among the most vulnerable in our society. It's just revolting. Sean Oosthuizen and Johnny DePlooy are exactly where they deserve to be, and our country is far better off for it. And hopefully they'll have a third joining them soon. Some of the most heart-rending parts of the research for this episode, we're reading some of the victim impact statements made by the grieving loved ones of the victims. Barbara Fenton's son-in-law said that losing their mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother had a severe and far-reaching effect on the family. He said that Barbara had been a big part of what held the family together, and visiting and spending time with her was also a big part of their lives, which they are no longer able to do. He said that the children and the family feel the loss of their great-grandmother badly and don't understand why she's gone. Engela van Wyk's daughter, Elna, said that although the trial was a grueling experience, she decided from the beginning that she would attend every court appearance. She said, "I decided from the start that I would go to court every single time, no matter how many times the case was postponed. I cried my eyes out every time we went to court. But I wanted them to see my mother mattered to someone. She was not just a number. I felt like I couldn't stay away. I needed to look them in the eyes." Elna said that although the trial was traumatic, it helped her to heal in a way. "It does something to you when you think about the fact that they were the last faces she saw before she took her last breath. I had to confront the loss head on." Elna said that she had forgiven DePlooy and Oosthuizen for what they'd done because she realized that her hatred for them would eat her alive and not do a single thing to them. She also said that she felt really bad for the offender's parents. And that brings me to a closing scene I want to leave you with, which I came across while researching. Sean Oosthuizen's elderly mother had attended court every single time her son appeared. The woman was clearly torn between the pain her son had caused so many and the love she had for him as her child. On one occasion, as particularly horrendous details were read out about what her son had done, the woman broke down and cried out to anyone who would listen, "Please forgive him." As she sobbed, family members of the victims approached her and wrapped their arms around her. In a moment of shared pain, all of those who had lost so many in so many different ways allowed their anger to abate and instead sought relief in another human being. Oosthuizen's mother was the exact victim profile he had targeted. Elderly, vulnerable. And she represented exactly what all those victims' families had lost. A maternal figure, a matriarch, who would go to war for those she loved. And somehow, in that courtroom, for just a moment, an unlikely placement of missing puzzle pieces slotted into place. The woman who had lost her son to his own greed and callousness had a family back. And the families who had lost their mothers and grandmothers had theirs back. Only for a moment, though. Because as the sobs subsided, the protective walls came back down. And everyone was left with their own personal gaping holes of grief. Emma Horsen, Engela van Wyk, Henrietta Potgieter, Lillis Mary, Barbara Fenton. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.